From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Dust off your watering cans and dig out your work boots. It's time to prepare your garden. From when to transplant seedlings outdoors to how deep raised beds should be, we get advice from Erin Melantine, Master Gardener Coordinator for the University of Maryland Extension in Baltimore City, and Kate Blom, Supervisor of the Howard Peters Rawlings Conservatory and Botanic Gardens. Melantine explains an essential step before planting.
Soil tests can really help you determine both the nutrient content of your soil and also whether or not there are certain heavy metals like lead or arsenic that are in your soil that you need to be aware of.
Plus, flowers on display this weekend at the conservatory create an octopus's garden. It's on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Tis the season for soil testing, buying seeds, and starting plants indoors. You already may have seen trees blossoming and daffodils blooming, but the last frost of the season, the latest date temperatures can get down to 32 degrees, isn't expected until mid to late April for most of central Maryland. So today our focus is on planning your garden. I'm joined by two gardening experts. Erin Melantine is Master Gardener Coordinator for the University of Maryland Extension in Baltimore City. She joins us by phone. Welcome to On the Record.
Hi. Thank you, Sheila.
And Kate Blom is Supervisor of the Rawlings Conservatory and Botanic Gardens. The conservatory is located in Baltimore's Druid Hill Park and is open Wednesday through Sunday. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you.
Kate, what type of cleanup do people need to do before they start a garden?
Generally, you need to remove all the debris. You need to be careful, though, because of that frost that you mentioned. You need to, earlier in the spring, you can do a lot of cutting back of the of perennials and some of the woodies. I cut back a lot of my shrubs at that time. But I like to leave leaf litter on until I'm more confident of the temperatures.
Because the leaf litter can help protect a plant from a surprise frost.
Sure, it's like a blanket, kind of. So that's a good thing to leave. But the spring, early spring, is a great time to do some pruning. Because you can actually see the leaves, you can see the stems, you can see what's going to be going on, you can see where the stems cross, you can see what needs to be cleaned up.
You can see because the leaves aren't there yet.
Exactly. And when the leaves are there, it's, you know, really hard.
And is this a better time in the plant cycle to be doing that kind of cutting?
For a lot of plants, it is. For a lot of plants. Roses in particular is an early spring type of plant that should be pruned early March or so. It's not a bad idea to prune back perhaps your nine bark or something. What you need to be careful not to prune are your early spring flowering shrubs, because you'll be cutting off your flowers. So the azaleas, for instance, you want to wait until after they bloom and deal with the leaves. Anyway, that's life. But, enjoy that bloom, and then do your pruning on those types of plants.
Erin, you recommend soil testing. Why is this necessary?
Absolutely. Soil testing is important for several different reasons. The first one that I'm going to mention is of course, directly related to folks living in Baltimore City, but also in other areas that have had housing developments that potentially had homes that were painted with lead paint. Soil tests can really help you determine both the nutrient content of your soil and also whether or not there are certain heavy metals like lead or arsenic that are in your soil that you need to be aware of. These are things, that could cause potential health hazards if they're in too high of concentrations. And of course, with the plant nutrients, if they're in too low of concentrations, then you aren't going to have a healthy, beautiful garden like we all want.
Okay, soil testing is important. How do I do it? How do I get my soil tested?
There's many different regional soil testing laboratories. University of Maryland no longer has a soil testing lab, but Penn State has one, the University of Delaware has one. And these are things that there are directions online. I recommend that people go to the Home Garden Information Center website, which is the University of Maryland Extension webpage. And they just have a ton of information and a video even showing you how to take a soil test. So it's kind of an aggregate of soil from perhaps your one garden plot. And you have to take a sample that's about 6 inches deep in several different locations in your plot, mix them together, and you can actually mail that in with about $20. That's the average cost of a soil test to one of the soil testing laboratories, and then they will report back to you.
You say that the page that people can consult with is the Home Garden Information?
The Home Garden Information Center.
We will link to it from our page at WYPR.org. Erin, if someone is going to go the raised bed route, how deep do those beds need to be?
You know, if you're looking to grow vegetables, you know, and produce in your garden, you really want to make sure that you have enough depth of clean, good soil so that you can provide, you know, adequate root zone. A lot of times when folks are making raised beds, they're putting down a barrier between the potentially contaminated soil and then the new soil, the new fill. And so if you're doing that, you want to make sure that you have at least 6 to 8 inches of depth. And you also want to know where that soil is coming from, right? So you want to make sure that you know for a fact the soil, the clean soil that you're getting and putting into your raised bed is in fact clean and not contaminated as well.
And so what are your suggestions about getting that kind of good soil?
Yeah, I think going to verified sources for topsoil and for, you know, getting compost as well makes the most sense. Don't go on Craigslist and, you know, click on someone's link that's trying to give away topsoil. You know, if it's hard to trust sources like that, even if it's free, which is very tempting, you know, it's... you need to make sure that it gets tested before you decide then that that's something that you would want to put then in your yard, because someone's getting rid of it after all.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Master Gardener Erin Melantine and Kate Blom, supervisor of Baltimore's Rawlings Conservatory and Botanic Gardens. And we're talking about what you can do to get your garden ready as warmer weather approaches. Kate, should you always be planting in an area that gets lots of direct sunlight?
Oh, no. No, not always at all. There are so many wonderful plants for shade. I have a shade garden myself. We have a shady area at the conservatory in Druid Hill Park. There are a lot of plants that depends if you're talking vegetables and so forth, and a lot of the cutting gardens, yes, they want full sun. But there are an enormous range of gorgeous plant material for shady gardens, too.
What are some of your favorites?
Epimediums, Virginia bluebells, which are just starting to come up now. Forget-me-nots are blooming. The hostas are coming up. I love the hostas. The deer love the hostas. We all love the hostas. But astilbes, the ferns. I love so many different ferns, and there are so many available out in the market now that, you know, everyone can have a beautiful garden. Even if you don't actually have a yard, you can have a beautiful garden using containers. You know, if you have a patio and just a patio or a balcony, whether it faces the sun or it faces the shade, sure, you can't grow everything. But the key is to find out what you have, what kind of light, what kind of conditions you do have. And then I can guarantee you, you can find plants that will thrive in those conditions.
Erin, you mentioned compost a minute ago. Should you add compost to your soil if you're planting in the ground?
Yeah, compost is definitely a soil amendment. It's high in organic matter, which helps with water retention. It helps with the capacity for your soil once you've added it to retain nutrients, you know, has higher nutrient holding capacity. And, yeah, I think it does a lot of good in a lot of people's soil, especially those who have low organic matter.
And I assume the highest and purest form of compost is something you've composted yourself. But since a lot of people haven't gotten involved in that, where do you suggest they turn for compost?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, the things that you compost in your backyard are great. But I'm not necessarily sure that I would say that they're better than, you know, the commercial stuff that you can buy. You know, in this area, there's several big compost providers that I know a lot of, you know, gardens in the area turn to in smaller farms. And I would, you know, seek out these folks who, you know, are working at this more industrial level, because you'll probably get better prices.
Uh-huh. Kate, if you have seeds or bulbs left over from last year, are they still good?
If you've stored them properly, they can be great. Yeah. They found in the pyramids of Egypt viable wheat seed. You know, so if it's kept dry and at an even temperature, generally a little bit cool in a darker place, bulbs and seeds can last a great amount of time.
And so it doesn't have to be completely dark, a rather dark place? I mean, it doesn't have to be like inside a closet?
It doesn't have to be. Oh, no. No, it's not like trying to get a poinsettia to rebloom. It is more just dry is the most important thing contained. I use just Old Spice jars to keep the moisture out. Stuff like that. With bulbs, a lot of times we'll just store them in a crate, like an old bulb crate, the way they originally came from Holland, but just because those are slotted and there's a lot of airflow in those, and you can actually plant them the next year. We force a lot of bulbs for our spring show.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah, and people have had a lot of success.
I do want to pick up on that, but we need to take a quick break here. This is On the Record, and we're talking about gardening. Our gardening experts are going to stick with us. We'll have more on planting your garden when we come back. I'm Sheila Cass. Don't go away.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Dust off your watering cans, dig out your work boots. Spring has sprung, and today we're talking about gardening, how to get your garden ready. I'm joined by Erin Melantine, Master Gardener Coordinator for the University of Maryland Extension in Baltimore City, and Kate Blom, Supervisor of the Rawlings Conservatory. Erin, there are certain types of plants that turn out best when started indoors?
Yeah, I think that starting seeds indoors is one way to kind of give your plants a jump start. And when you're starting things indoors, like tomatoes, let's say, you're able to care for them better, you're able to keep an eye on them, and kind of keep some of those other pesty wildlife critters away while they're still small. And then transplanting them outdoors, there's kind of a couple steps that you should go through in order to get that seedling from inside your house to outside and ready for the garden. Because if you just take your seedling from indoors and put it directly in the ground, it's just the immediate change, you know, the UV radiation from the sun, the wind potentially, the heat, direct heat and sunlight, or the cold temperature of the soil, if the soil hasn't quite warmed up yet, all of those things can factor into, you know, a transplant, which would originally be a good idea, end up not being as successful as you want it to be. So, you know, kind of getting your transplants outdoors gradually, having them in a partially shaded area and slightly protected area for about a week before putting them directly in the ground and in your garden is always a really good idea.
Well, back up even before that, how do I know when they're ready to go outside to start the transplant process?
Usually once they have some kind of adult-sized true leaves. So when a seed first sprouts and germinates, the vast majority of seeds, there are two cotyledons, and they are the first seed leaves that come out of the ground. But those aren't typically the true leaves. They look different than the leaves of the adult plant. So once you see the leaves of the adult plant, you know, and you see several sets of them, you have, you know, a sturdier stalk on your plant, you know, you might have to pot up several times, meaning you might start in much smaller containers, move them up to a little bit larger containers and a little bit larger containers. You know, but once you have a sturdy, healthy-looking plant with some adult leaves, that's when you know it's about time to go outside. And when it's that time to put it in the ground.
And so the first step then, when you think this plant is about ready to go outdoors, the first of these steps of transition would be?
The process is called hardening off. I like to put my plants in an area that has some shade and maybe a bit of a windbreak. And it will have, you know, shade for probably about half the day. Because I'm talking mostly about vegetable transplants at this point. When you're putting those out into your vegetable garden hopefully has full sun. It has a lot of sun. And providing that brief transition period for about a week outside in that somewhat shaded spot or with a shade cloth over them, that's another thing that people do sometimes, helps keep some of that UV radiation at a minimum because plants can get sunburned if you transition them too quickly from indoors to outdoors. So, you know, finding that perfect location for those transplants to just hang out for about a week is really what you have to do. And keeping an eye on the temperature, making sure it's not going to dip below freezing for any nights or get colder than the specific, you know, type of plant you have out there, right? So tomatoes really don't want to be much colder than 55, 60 degrees. So that would be, you know, your low that you're kind of looking at there.
Kate Blum, the cold season crops that you could actually put in the ground now or soon, what would they include?
A lot of lettuce, cabbage, beans, peas, broccoli is another one. I have asparagus that's coming up, but that's a horse of a different color.
What are then the next vegetables you'd plant? Warm weather.
Yeah,
plants.
I might, in all honesty, defer to my colleague about vegetables because I am just beginning my vegetable career. I've been flowers all over the place.
Erin, so you mentioned tomatoes like it pretty warm. What else?
Yeah, summer squash. Zucchini is a type of summer squash. You can have those, the yellow summer squash with either the crooknecks or the patty pan squashes. You actually want to have your winter squash in the ground by summertime because it's going to continue to grow, and then you harvest it in the fall, and it stores throughout the winter. So it's kind of a misleading name there with winter squash. You know, you can continue to try and grow some lettuces, but lettuces have a harder time in the heat. Same with kale. Kale is more of a cool season crop, as is, you know, you can have your spring onions and things like that in the spring and the fall on either end of the summer. And garlic is something that you start actually the fall before you want to harvest it. And then you'll be harvesting the garlic coming up into the late summer there.
I was just thinking about my garlic and its success over the winter and how eager I am to dig it up.
It stayed outside all winter?
Yes, I planted it in the fall.
And it's doing okay?
It's great.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast speaking with Kate Blum, supervisor of Baltimore's Rawlings Conservatory and Botanic Gardens, and master gardener Erin Melantine. We're talking about the ins and outs of preparing your garden. Erin, if you spot something in your garden and you're not sure if it's a weed, what can you do?
That's when I would find the nearest master gardener volunteer that lives in your neighborhood. There are also things you can do. You know, there's actually some kind of cool apps on your phone, you know, that you can download. I've used a couple of them and found them to be somewhat helpful, depending on the sort of weed you're looking at. But, you know, there's a lot of research that you can do online. But learning how to describe a plant, I think, is one of the important factors in identifying plants. Are the leaves exactly opposite one another? Are they alternate one another? Is the plant hairy? Is it smooth and there's no hairs? You know, what shape are the leaves? I think that there's a lot of kind of self-education that we can do as gardeners to start learning how to describe and talk about plants, because that is really the key then to identifying them. There's a book that I particularly like called Weeds of the Northeast, and that I found very helpful, especially moving from the Midwest over to the Mid-Atlantic area to kind of familiarize myself with weeds in this area.
Weeds of the Northeast. Speaking of describing things, Kate, if someone hasn't visited the conservatory, how do you describe it to them?
Oh, my goodness. It's a incredible garden in the center of a beautiful park. It's old. It's very old. It's 127 years old, which makes it one of the oldest conservatories still left in the country, for starters. we have a palm house and an orchid room, and then we have three greenhouses that feature different biomes. So we have a desert house and a rainforest house and a Mediterranean house. So there, we like to bring children to the conservatory and tie it up with their curriculum so that they can actually experience the changes of the different climates around the world and the different kinds of plants that grow in those climates. So that's one thing that you can see. And then I'm so eager to talk about the spring show. I don't know if this
I do
is a good
ask you
time,
about,
but I am so eager.
I do want to ask you about the spring show. It starts Saturday. It runs through April 23rd. And the Spring Flower Display's theme this year is An Octopus's Garden.
It is.
How are you creating this underwater world at the conservatory?
We are planning on hopefully having people walk into the conservatory and feel as though they have fallen, first of all, into a wetland area, and then as they travel farther, they have gone into a deep sea ocean. So we have created a lot of critters, if you will, like a 9-foot whale shark that's soaring up high in the ceiling above. There are boats in the ceiling. There's a scuba diver up there. So, and then the plants, it's really interesting. Of course, we have thousands of tulips and hyacinths and daffodils and muscarian and all those springtime favorites that we've been working on since last November. But what I've found is I've been choosing plant material for these underwater scenarios is that the desert plants and the succulent plants lend themselves very well to the geography of an underwater scene, as well as the air plants and the tillandsias and bromeliads. There are things when you're walking through looking and searching for plants to fit into a theme, you go, oh, you know, that looks a whole lot like coral, that Euphorbia monstera. You know, that is really cool. That's going in the show. So it's kind of, it's an educational, there's an educational component. We partner with the National Aquarium and with Enoch Pratt and created a jellyfish reading nook. And those two organizations have provided some books about the sea and about sustainability for ages 1 through 12, I believe. You know, so it's really all about the ocean, really, and the flowers.
And you control when some of these plants bloom. How do you do that?
We do it. It's tricky sometimes, but basically we get everything potted up before the new year. And we hold these plants in a walk-in cooler, a very large walk-in cooler. So we have pots and pots of the different flavors of different hyacinths, daffodils, and so forth. And then we kind of look at the calendar, and you can count back by week is one way of looking at it. Maybe tulips generally will take 3 weeks. You can bring them out. They look like little white. They look like asparagus. They look like little white things poking out of the ground. But within a day, they've started to turn green, and the leaves come out, and then soon the buds start to form, and they come up. So typically for a tulip, for example, it takes 3 weeks. So we bring them out in stages because we have 3 weekends of bloom time. So it's a back-and-forth process every single day.
Erin, here in Baltimore, people can connect with the Extension at a couple of farmers markets across the city.
Mm-hmm. Actually, the best way is that you could actually come and get something ID'd is either taking pictures and bringing that to one of the farmers markets, the Waverly Farmers Market, the JFX Market. We occasionally have Ask Master Gardener Plant Clinics up at the Druid Hill Park Farmers Market and also in Lauraville, Hamilton. And those are Ask a Master Gardener Plant Clinics. And so if you take really good photos of something that you want ID'd, one of the master gardeners, you know, tabling at one of the markets might be able to help you identify it. And it's a really good way to interact directly with the master gardeners. We also have what we call the Grow It, Eat It series. And so that's all about vegetable gardening. We have several series, one with Parks and People Foundation. We'll have some Grow It, Eat It classes held there throughout the year. And then also in May to June at, I think there are 12 different branches of the Enoch Pratt Library, we are also having some beginner gardening classes, some beginner vegetable gardening classes.
We are almost out of time. Do either of you have brief words of wisdom for someone who doesn't have much experience gardening but wants to jump in?
My favorite advice that I've learned the hard way is to really pay attention to the directions for each particular plant as to when to plant it indoors and when to take it outside, because typically those catalogs start coming in February and we all get really, really anxious and we're sick of winter and we want to just jump in and do it. And if you jump in and do it too soon, and you end up having the plants inside too long, then they get really leggy and stuff. So you've got to hold back and really pay attention. The guys who do this really do know what they're doing. You know, you got to read the directions.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Read the seed packet. Read the back of the seed packet. That will let you know when you should start your transplants, when you should start getting, you know, ready to take them outside. There's also some material to help you do this on, again, the Home Garden Information website. There's kind of a mock-up of a planting schedule, which gives you kind of, if you want to start the seeds outside versus inside, you know, when to do that and what sorts of plants you should be looking at doing that with.
Well, I appreciate the good advice from both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you so much.
Erin Melantine, Master Gardener Coordinator for the University of Maryland Extension in Baltimore City, and Kate Blom, Supervisor of the Rawlings Conservatory and Botanic Gardens. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we have links to the University of Maryland Extension and to the Rawlings Conservatory and Botanic Gardens. The Conservatory's spring flower display with the theme An Octopus's Garden starts Saturday and runs through April 23rd. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're listening. Join us again tomorrow.